Support for 89.7 NPR News comes from The James at Ohio State, providing access to the most advanced cancer treatments available from a team specialized in treating just one type of cancer, yours. Learn more at cancer.osu.edu/choosethejames.
Welcome to All Sides with Amy Jurevich. Oscar season is officially underway, and there are definitely some surprise picks, but also some expected hits. Sinners, one of the most successful movies of the year, broke the record for all-time nominations of a film by the Academy. But will that be enough to fight off another heavy hitter, like one battle after another? And the Oscars aren't the only place for big-budget studio movies. What films went under the radar this year, and what deserved more praise? Joining us now is Alyssa Wilkinson, film critic at The New York Times. Welcome to the show, Alyssa.
Thanks. It's so good to be here.
Overall, what did you think of the Oscar nominations this year? Do you agree with most of the Academy's decisions?
You know, Oscar nominations are always funny because some movies get left off that are your favorites. That's just part of the deal. But overall, I thought they were pretty good this year. There are some surprises that, you know, I cheered, and some that I kind of rolled my eyes, but I felt pretty good about them.
Well, let's start with what was your favorite movie that you feel got left off? Did you have one?
The one that I thought didn't get enough love was It Was Just an Accident, which was Jafar Panahi's movie, the Iranian director. I really, you know, was hoping that he would show up more in the nominations. He's someone who has really been making movies in secret, really, in Iran, and has gone to prison for this. And his movie is fantastic, and I hope more people see it. And he didn't end up with a directing nomination. But, you know, it still is in the mix, and I hope that people make a point of seeing it, even though, you know, he didn't end up ultimately with a nomination.
What's the name of that movie again?
It Was Just an Accident.
So it's nominated for International Feature Film.
It is nominated for International Feature Film. That's right.
And this ballot that I have, which happens to be from Rotten Tomatoes, it has a really high score. So a lot of people like this movie.
That's right. It won the Palme d'Or at Cannes Film Festival last year, which is sort of the highest, you know, honor that you can win an international film. So that was great. But often, you know, international films only get really seen by U.S. audiences sometimes when they show up at the Oscars. So, you know, it has a good chance of winning that international Oscar, but I hope that people also make a point of seeing it. It's a kind of a funny film. It's a political film. It's a thrilling film. It's all of those things. And it has a great distributor in Neon. So we can hope that people seek it out.
So let's talk about what seems to be the biggest rivalry going on this year, which is Sinners versus One Battle After Another. What did you think of these two movies? Did they deserve all the nominations that they got?
I think so. I mean, they both landed on my top 10 list this year. One Battle After Another was my favorite film of the year. Sinners also was on my top 10 list. I think they're both pretty spectacular films. What I love about both of them is they're very singular visions. You know, they're both weird movies in their own way. They're both very representative of their directors' visions, P.T. Anderson on one hand and Ryan Coogler on the other. If you go see them in a theater where you can really see them in their full format, IMAX or VistaVision or whatever, you will have just a blast. They're wild movies to watch. And I wasn't actually sure either of them were going to get this much love from the Academy because they're both such weird movies. And I think it really speaks to the work that the Academy, which is, you know, the group of film professionals who picked the Oscars, they've worked really hard over the past decade to expand their membership and make it broader. And I think that really speaks to what good work they've done in doing that, that these movies have gotten this much love.
So the weird now has a chance.
Yeah, you know, movies that really represent a vision and aren't just your typical Oscar bait the way we might have talked about it 15 or 20 years ago.
Yeah. So speaking of Sinners, we're going to listen to a part of one of its most iconic scenes.
There are legends of people born with the gift of making music so true it can pierce the veil between life and death, conjuring spirits from the past. Somebody take me. And the future.
So when you watch the trailer for Sinners, it seems like a movie about one thing, and then it takes that unexpected turn. So
yes, it sure does.
It sure does. Where I was not, I mean, maybe I was expecting a horror movie, but maybe not in that way. I don't know. But anyway, so Sinners broke Oscar history. It's the first ever film being nominated for 16 Oscars. What does that mean overall for the industry to have a film have that many nominations?
Well, it's not just that many nominations either. It was one of the most successful films of the year at the box office too, which is, you know, actually wild for so many reasons, one of which is, you know, almost the entire cast is Black actors. You know, it has a director at the helm who's very commercially successful, like as a Marvel director, but also as an independent director. So this movie in many ways is just a juggernaut on every front. And I think that sometimes Hollywood learns the right lesson from that, which is that you should hand somebody a blank check and say, go for it, do what it is that you want to do. And sometimes they can come up with something like that. Will that be the lesson that is learned? I don't know. But, you know, when you get a movie like this, hopefully it tells you that sometimes a movie that on paper doesn't look like it will be a huge success, both critically and commercially, can actually be a big success. And it's worth taking a risk on those movies and, you know, giving them the big budget that they deserve.
I mean, some of the films that had the most nominations previously were like Titanic and La La Land, right?
Yes,
and it's so, that's right. Sinners is so different than those.
So different. And, you know, like you said, it's a horror film. And I had so many people come by my desk at work and say, well, I don't really like horror films, but I love this movie. And I said, you might like horror films. You like this movie, actually.
Oh, no. So the if it is a battle between Sinners and one battle after another, I mean, who do you think is going to come out on top here?
You know, it's really hard to say. Part of the way that, you know, this works is that we have 10,000 people voting literally for these. So it may come down to a few votes. These things often work out. And I think that, you know, these sorts of things are basically unpredictable to in the extreme. I try not to make those predictions. But what is definitely true is that both of these have wound up with kind of historic years for both of them. And I think, you know, what I love about One Battle After Another is that Paul Thomas Anderson has been making incredible movies for a very long time, and they've generally been ignored by the Academy. And for this movie to finally break through is really exciting for me. And, you know, the second you sit down and start watching that movie, you really feel like you're in the hands of someone who's just incredibly confident in what they're doing. And every second of that movie feels very confident. So they're both great choices. I couldn't possibly pick between them. And I hope that we remember this year as a year where really singular visions were rewarded.
This is All Sides on 89.7 NPR News. We're talking about the Oscars with Alyssa Wilkinson, film critic at the New York Times. Let's talk beyond the Best Picture category. Do you have a favorite category at the Oscars?
Well, I mean, it changes from year to year. I think this year, you know, we have some interesting categories. For instance, there's a new category this year, casting. This is the first year that we've had a casting category. I don't even know that people really know what it is. I'm still figuring it out.
But there's some other awards that do a casting award, right? Aren't there other it's not the Golden Globes, but the other one.
No, like the Screen Actors Guild, I believe. But, you know, it's interesting to look at it. Hamnet, Marty Supreme, One Battle After Another, The Secret Agent, you know, which has really been kind of you know, it's done really well this award season, and Sinners. And so that's a really fun award to look at, because the question is, what does that even mean? And it's like finding actors who maybe are unexpected for these kinds of roles. And, you know, I think Marty Supreme is a great example in here. There are people in that movie who I just would never have even expected to see in a movie like that. Fran Drescher is in that movie.
And Kevin O'Leary from Shark Tank.
Yeah, multiple seasons, yeah. You know, multiple scenes to even realize it was her. So I love watching that. And I was so, so excited to see Delroy Lindo in the supporting actor category this time, because he is one guy who has been phenomenal his entire career. And he is a person, I hate the word snub when it comes to the Oscars, but he's a person who I feel has truly been snubbed by the Academy over and over again. And being nominated for his role in Sinners was so exciting. to see. And, you know, even if it means that maybe someone like Paul Mescal playing William Shakespeare didn't make it into the category, I think I screamed on my couch when I saw him show up.
Back to the casting category for a minute.
Yeah.
They expanded the Best Picture category to include 10, up to 10 now. But
That's
for
right.
best casting, it's still there's five. And
That's right.
I've been reading a lot of things where they're saying that, like, will it be best casting wins best picture, or is it just would the one that comes in second place for best picture is going to get casting or something like that? What do you think?
Yeah, I don't know. You know, it'll be interesting to see how that shakes out. Often strange things happen. Like often the movie that wins best editing wins best picture. It's a little kooky. You know, technically, I think the thing people don't always realize is best picture goes to the producers of the film. So, you know, we're actually the best predictor for what's going to win best picture is often whatever wins the Producers Guild Award.
Oh, okay.
So, you know, the way the Academy votes on these things is very strange, and a lot of people, you know, who follow these things very closely, there's all this strange calculus that goes on behind it. But because casting is so new, it's sort of up in the air, and it'll take a few years for us to really realize what it's a predictor for.
Right. Are there any movies you mentioned that the one movie that's nominated for international feature film that you hope more people see? I forgot the name again. I'm sorry. It was
It was just
just
an
an accident. It
accident.
was just an
Yeah.
accident. But are there any other movies that maybe didn't make it onto this list that you wish people would see?
Yes. The one I would really push is The Testament of Anne Lee, which stars Amanda Seyfried as Anne Lee, who was the founder of the Shakers, which is a religious sect from the 18th century. And it's So I'm going to say it's a musical, but when I say that, it's not what people think of when they say musical. It's not like they stop and sing a song and then go on. It's this very strange, odd movie, directed by Mona Fassbold, who people might know as the co-writer of The Brutalist from last year. It is not a movie that's anything like The Brutalist. And it's another one of those movies that's very singular. It's very kind of I would say feminine in a way that is unexpected. But it's a biopic of this woman who just had this very, again, like singular vision of what the world should be. She was, you know, had an idea of what equality, radical gender equality, radical justice would look like. And she went for it, and was the leader of this religious sect. And so Amanda Seyfried's performance is extraordinary in it. It's not a movie that's gotten as much attention as it should have, although Amanda Seyfried was nominated for a Golden Globe for her role, and it didn't end up with any Oscar nominations, but I hope that people can find a way to see it, because it's one of those movies, again, where, you know, it's worth looking up, even if it doesn't end up being your taste, because it's just so unlike any other movie that you will ever see, I think, in your
Oh.
life.
What was the name of it again?
The Testament of Anne Lee.
Okay. And another overlooked portion of the awards is always documentary and also short
That's right.
film. Is there any documentary on this list that you would recommend people try to see?
Yeah, I mean, they're all pretty good, but the one that I think everybody should look up is Come See Me in the Good Light. It is about the poet Andrea Gibson and their wife, and it is so Andrea Gibson had a very aggressive cancer and passed away between when the film premiered at Sundance last year and when it opened later in the year, which makes it sound like it's going to be very sad, but it's actually like the most uplifting, beautiful, joyful film that you can imagine. It's streaming on Apple TV if you have access to that, but it's this beautiful, beautiful film about like kind of coming to terms with your mortality and having that become the way that you find joy in life and start really living. It will make you cry, absolutely. I just have to warn everybody, you will weep. But it is so beautiful, so life-affirming, so gorgeous. It's just kind of about their life together, their love, and this just beautiful kind of experience of trying to live through that. So I really highly recommend it. It is it is a gorgeous film. Come see me in the good light.
Our student producer, Colin, he just chimed in and was like, really, really good movie with lots of exclamation points.
Really, really good.
Really, really good. All right. People have some time to watch a few movies before the Oscar ceremony. Is there anything that you would recommend that people watch off of the Best Picture list? Because we mainly only talked about a couple of them, but there's 10 on here. What should people be sure to see?
Well, I would make sure you see Train Dreams, actually. It's a small film. I was so delighted that it wound up with a Best Picture nomination. It's on Netflix. It is this small film starring Joel Edgerton. It's about a man who lives his life, which doesn't sound like much, but it is absolutely gorgeous. It was shot in the Pacific Northwest, and it is based on a small novella, and it is just sort of his experience of sort of life and then loss and then life after loss. Everyone who has watched this movie, I've been getting emails for months from people who watched the movie because they read my review and then are like, this was the most meaningful experience I've had all year. So you can find it on Netflix, a really, really, really beautiful movie. And then I also really loved Guillermo del Toro's Frankenstein, which is also on Netflix. They're not paying me to say this. but in particular, I love Jacob Elordi's performance as Frankenstein's creature. I think it's actually like possibly Elordi's best performance I've ever seen. He'll break your heart. But there's been millions and millions of adaptations of Frankenstein, and Del Toro just really has his finger on the pulse of what that story is all about. So I think I wouldn't skip over it if you have the chance to watch it before the ceremony, just to sort of see. And Elordi is nominated for his performance as well. Mm-hmm. So I'm not expecting him to win, but I think he deserves the nomination for sure.
Well, I want to thank you so much for joining us to discuss this. We've been talking with Alyssa Wilkinson, film critic at The New York Times. Thank you so much for joining us today.
Absolutely. Thank you so much.
Coming up, we're going to talk more about the Oscar nominations and what movies you might have missed. That is when All Sides continues on 89.7 NPR News.
This is Tanya Mosley, co-host of Fresh Air. You'll see your favorite actors, directors, and comedians on late-night TV shows or YouTube, but what you get with Fresh Air is a deep dive. Spend some quality time with people like Billie Eilish, Questlove, Ariana Grande, Stephen Colbert, and so many more. We ask questions you won't hear asked anywhere else. Listen to the Fresh Air podcast from NPR and WHYY.
You're listening to All Sides. I'm your host, Amy Jarovich. 2025 was a big year for movies, with releases like A24's Marty Supreme and Apple Studios' F1. There was a wide range of movies to enjoy, from gritty biopics to tender love stories, animated kids movies, and edge-of-your-seat action flicks. There is something for everyone on the silver screen in 2025. If you missed some of the biggest films of the year, which ones are worth going back and checking out, and what should you be on the lookout for in 2026? Joining us now is Scott Mance, film critic, entertainment journalist, and producer. Welcome back to the show, Scott.
Thanks so much for having me, Amy. Great to be here.
So, Oscar nominations aside, now that we're in 2026, can you pick what was your favorite movie last year?
Oh, it is easy for me to pick my favorite movie of 2025. And it is the movie, I have to say, that got the most Oscar nominations of this year or any year, making history, Hollywood history, Academy Awards history with 16 nominations. Amy, that movie, of course, is Sinners.
That was your favorite of the year? Yeah.
It was my favorite of the year. And Amy, the reason why is because that movie opened last April. And I remember watching that film for the first time of many times. I've seen it now in theaters and at home because it's on HBO Max. I was on the edge of my seat about halfway through. I just couldn't believe what I was watching. It was such an original film, such an incredible fusion of a period pick, a movie that tackles racism, and of course, a genre film because it deals with vampires and it has such an empowering conclusion. But that was a movie that just really stayed in the conversation. You know, a lot of times a movie that comes out earlier in the year, it kind of gets forgotten by the time the Oscars roll around, or the nominations anyway. But that movie stayed at the top of the conversation. And look, I loved Marty Supreme, and I love One Battle After Another, but Sinners is the one that I thought was the biggest swing, and that is why it was my favorite movie of 2025.
Yeah, we were talking with Alyssa from the New York Times, and she said that a lot of people have said to her, oh, I don't like horror movies, but they liked Sinners. So maybe, she said, maybe you do like horror movies then. Would you agree?
Well, absolutely, because Sinners is so much more than a horror movie. I mean, for like the first half of the movie, if not longer, it's not a horror movie at all. Mm-hmm. It's a movie about these twin brothers who go back to the South to open up a music club, and they're faced with racism, bigotry. This is the Jim Crow South, and Michael B. Jordan plays both roles, and that's really hard to do, and it's kind of seamless the way that he's acting alongside himself. I mean, that's a feat unto itself. But then the movie takes a turn, and you're like, oh, now we're in that kind of a film. But it's like two movies, but they work so well together, and they complement each other and elevate each other to something that's really, really incredible. I mean, it's incredible that writer, producer, director Ryan Coogler, he's nominated in all those categories, really pulled it off. And Michael B. Jordan, and big surprise Oscar nomination for Delroy Lindo, his very first Oscar nomination, which is incredible after getting snubbed for Defy Bloods a few years ago, the Spike Lee movie. But yeah, when I tell people, don't worry, it's more than a genre film. It's so much more. It really, really is.
Is there any movie that you found was a big disappointment from last year?
Yes. Mm. All right, Amy. I remember last year we kind of had a disagreement. Like, there was a movie that you loved and I wasn't crazy about it. The movie that was the biggest disappointment to me in 2025, are you ready?
Mm-hmm.
It did not go up, up, and away. There's the hint. Superman.
I liked Superman.
Knew it! I knew it! Amy, call me old school, but to me, Christopher Reeve is still the quintessential movie Superman. And Clark Kent. A lot of people don't remember that he played two roles and he played them both great. But that first Superman movie, directed by Richard Donner, 1978, is still the gold standard of superhero movies, even after all these years, even with all the Avengers and Marvel and DC movies. But I just felt like here you're doing a reboot of Superman. You're starting all over. And I thought, okay, this is great. They're just going to tell a standalone Superman movie. It's going to be a love story with Lois Lane. And, you know, I thought the guy who played Superman and Clark Kent, Dave Corenswet, was fantastic. But there is so much going on in the film. There was hardly any scenes between him, Clark Kent or Superman, and Lois Lane, played by the amazing Emmy winner Rachel Brosnahan. There were like three or four scenes of them together, and yet all this other stuff going on with all these other superheroes and the Justice League and too many villains. And I just went, what's going on here? Just give me a standalone Superman movie. Is that too much to ask?
Yes, was my biggest it is too point. Much to ask. Yes. I thought that you and I were going to disagree about Wicked. I think that's what we disagreed about last year, isn't it?
Oh, yeah. Wicked. Mm-hmm. Well, what did you think of Wicked? You go first.
Oh, well, I loved Wicked for good. I thought it was so powerful, and I enjoyed it, and my kids loved it, and we just had so much fun with it. But it didn't get any nominations, so I'm wrong.
No. You're never wrong for, you know, it's all subjective anyway, Amy. Mm-hmm. So if you loved Wicked, then you loved Wicked. I loved the first movie. I thought the first movie was great, and it was nominated for 10 Oscars, and it won two of them. Mm-hmm. But that's correct. The second movie, Wicked for Good, which opened about a year to the day of the first movie, it got completely shut out. No nominations, not even for hair, makeup, and wardrobe. That to me was pretty shocking. But I did not like Wicked for Good as much as the first movie. I liked it. I was entertained, but when I was talking to people about not liking Wicked for Good as much as the first, they're like, oh, well, the movie musical, part two is not as good as part one. Well, then I'm like, Well, there you go.
I guess anyone who has seen the Broadway show knows what part two is like. Yes.
Exactly. Yes, yeah. Correct.
There's been a lot of discussion around the Brad Pitt movie, F1. Let's hear a clip from it real quick.
Come on! Gex!
Guys, talk to me. Where's Sonny? Can he finish?
One more lap, JP. Hamilton never backs down.
Can Sonny finish the race, man?
Yes, he's on track. Just watch Lewis when he fights. You're P1. No more risks.
No such thing.
Were you surprised that this ended up in the Best Picture category?
No, I'm not surprised, Amy, because I was actually predicting, you know, leading up to the nominations that it was going to get in, and for a few reasons. I mean, the story feels like an old-fashioned sort of like, you know, like this aging sports guy is trying to make a comeback after an injury, and he's dealing with the younger protege who's got like the attitude problem. But the racing scenes were absolutely fantastic. I mean, it's produced by Jerry Bruckheimer, who goes back to 1990s Days of Thunder with Tom Cruise. Mm. That's a racing movie. And here you have F1, the movie, which was just fantastic. And so first of all, F1 was nominated for 4 Academy Awards, including Best Picture. Mm. And when I saw that movie last year for the first time, Amy, I saw it in IMAX and I thought it was great. I love the racing scenes. It was really visceral, puts you in the driver's seat. But then when I saw it a second time, Amy, I saw it in Dolby Atmos, the sound. Mm. And from the beginning of the film, the first like 5 or 10 minutes, the sound was like, I've never been in a film where the sound just like made your heart shake, you know? Mm. And it was an even better experience than seeing it in IMAX, because the sound really made the movie. That was a true testament to Dolby and like how sound can really make a movie better.
Well, and the sound category in the Oscars is one no one ever talks about. But do you think that is pretty much a lock for winning Best Sound then?
I think it's definitely up there. Mm-hmm. It's definitely should be. You know, Top Gun Maverick won 3 years ago, mm-hmm, for sound. And that was also produced by Jerry Bruckheimer and directed by Joseph Kosinski, the same team that worked on F1.
Well, what if the 10,000 people who vote for the Oscars didn't watch it in Dolby, whatever you call that, you know, then they won't know.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, if they watched it at home, I don't know if they're going to have the same experience. Mm-hmm. But, you know, the Apple TV and Warner Brothers, they really made sure, you know, they had a lot of screenings here in Los Angeles, Q&As, where, you know, Bruckheimer and Joseph Kosinski and, you know, the crafts team did Q&As, and they invited every Academy voter under the sun to make sure they saw it in a premium experience.
This is All Sides on 89.7 NPR News. We're talking about movies with Scott Mance, film critic, entertainment journalist, and producer. One of the biggest movies of the year was Marty Supreme. Let's listen.
I don't think you understand the stakes here. You find that funny?
I get nervous laughter sometimes.
Are my eyes broke or is that mouse, baby?
Thank you so much.
You're my pop. We believe in you.
Hey, I'll rip that unibrow right off his forehead! All right.
You want to get physical? Like an 8?
What did you think of this film, Marty Supreme?
I loved it. Mm-hmm. Amy, I loved it. I got to tell you, though, the first time I saw the movie, I was out of breath. Mm. When it was over, I was exhausted. I felt like I ran a marathon. I felt like
who knew a table tennis could be so dramatic? Yeah.
That movie, it was, you know, so of course it's directed by Josh Safdie, who along with his brother Benny had directed the movie Uncut Gems with Adam Sandler a few years before. And that was a similar film that, like, you know, had a very anxiety ridden vibe to it. But it also is a fantastic film. I mean, you know, if you do see it again, you're going to get a lot more out of it the second time you see it. I thought the movie, you know, kind of went off in some crazy direction when he's dealing with the dog. If you saw the movie, you know what I'm talking about. Like, where is this movie going? But the way it came back to the table tennis match and that final scene, if you haven't seen it, I want to spoil it. But the final scene really did, in spite of how crazy the movie got and the crazy direction it went off in, it did kind of bring it back home to a very emotionally satisfying conclusion. And Timothée Chalamet, nominated for his third Academy Award just 1 year after his Oscar-nominated turn playing Bob Dylan in A Complete Unknown, I feel like he's the front runner here. He's probably going to win it.
So you think that that he's the front runner over Michael B. Jordan, who played two people? Yeah.
You know, I'll tell you what, Amy. I think that if anybody is going to if anybody's going to take it over Timothée Chalamet, I feel like, it could be a couple people here. I mean, look, I think Michael B. Jordan is fantastic in Sinners. And again, his first nomination, he's playing two roles. But I think Ethan Hawke, this getting his fifth Oscar nomination, his third Oscar nomination for acting after Training Day and Boyhood. I mean, that movie is incredible because of all the dialogue Ethan Hawke had to remember and just the complete immersion and disappearance into the role of Lawrence Hart, half of Rodgers and Hart, the songwriting duo. And it's the performance of his career. He's beloved in Hollywood. And Timothée Chalamet, I mean, you could say he's a little younger, but I do feel like because Marty Supreme is now the highest grossing movie from A24 with $150 million worldwide, more people saw Marty Supreme, which is why I feel like Timothée Chalamet does have the edge here.
Yeah, I was just going to say Ethan Hawke is in a movie called Blue Moon, but I'm sorry. I haven't heard of it. I missed it.
Yeah.
I'm not alone there.
$2 million.
Yeah. How much? I'm sorry.
$2 million.
Oh, poor movie. Okay. Yeah. So are there any movies that maybe didn't appear on the Oscar list that you watched in the past year that you loved that you wished more people had seen?
That is a great question, Amy. And boy, do I have an answer that I am ready to go with here, because I've been saying this now for a couple months. Mm-hmm. The movie Nuremberg, written and directed by James Vanderbilt, about a psychiatrist who is analyzing basically Hitler's number two guy, and played by Russell Crowe, is a powerful film. It is an incredible film. It is a movie that speaks very much to, I'm just going to say, today's political climate. But also features incredible turns from Rami Malek and Russell Crowe's best performance since like Cinderella Man 20 years ago. That movie didn't get anything, and I sure wish it did, because everyone I know who has seen Nuremberg, and that is a movie that did do really well at the box office, making $50 million worldwide. Everyone I know who saw Nuremberg loved it. If you did not see it and you're listening to this segment here, make sure you stream it. You might have to pay for it to rent it, but it is worth it. That is a movie I thought for sure would at least get a screenplay nomination. It was shut out. I love Nuremberg. It's a fantastic movie.
Is there anything to be said about when movies come out during the year, of whether, because you mentioned that F1 kind of got forgotten, or it does it matter when the movie comes out to make it onto the Oscar ballot?
Well, it's always better, Amy, if a movie comes out after September. And it's always best if a movie plays at the fall film festivals known as the Telluride Film Festival, the Toronto Film Festival, and the Venice Film Festival. Those happen basically on top of each other in the first week of September. That's the real start of award season. If your movies play there, then those are the movies that are most likely going to get the most nominations. However, one battle after another, it did not play at those festivals, though it did open at the end of September on its way to, I think, 11 Oscar nominations, including Best Picture. It's probably going to win Best Picture, Director, and Adapted Screenplay. But Sinners came out in April. So that got the most nominations. A couple years ago, Everything Everywhere All at Once opened at the end of March. At the end of March, after premiering at the South by Southwest Film Festival in 2022. And that movie made Oscar history with, I think, seven wins, including Best Picture. So most of the time, I would say, sure, yeah, you want to release your Oscar contender towards the end of the year because that's when people or Oscar voters are really thinking that way. But it doesn't mean that you only have to release it at the end of the year. There are exceptions.
Is there any movie you're really excited to see in 2026 coming up this year?
Well, I'm going to be honest with you, Amy. As much as I was disappointed by Superman, I am a lifelong Spider-Man fan. So I'm very excited for the new Spider-Man movie, Brand New Day, which opens in July. I'm really excited for the Michael Jackson movie called Michael, which opens in April, directed by Antoine Fuqua, who directed Training Day, starring Oscar nominee Ethan Hawke. And also, I'm very excited for people to see the new Ryan Gosling movie, Project Hail Mary. Those are just some of the movies I'm really excited to see. Of course, I'm excited about, you know, Avengers Doomsday. You know, I love the Avengers movies, and Avengers Endgame is one of the greatest superhero movies ever. So, you know, I do love those movies, but I'm really curious to see what people think of the Michael Jackson movie.
All right. And so Ethan Hawke, if he doesn't win for Blue Moon, he'll have another chance maybe for another Oscar.
Ethan Hawke is doing the best work of his career. He's got his FX show Lowdown, which he's great in. I just saw the movie called The Wait at the Sundance Film Festival, the last ever Sundance in Park City. He's great in that. Ethan Hawke is at the top of his game, and he's been at this for more than 40 years.
Busy guy. All right. Well, I want to thank you so much for your time. We've been talking with Scott Mance, film critic, entertainment journalist, and producer. Thanks for joining us on All Sides today.
Thanks so much, Amy. Great talking with you.
And coming up, we are going to talk about the box office booms and the bombs, because in the end, isn't it all about money? That's when All Sides continues on 89.7 NPR News. You're listening to All Sides. I'm your host, Amy Jurevich. Like every year, there are huge box office successes and bombs coming out of Hollywood. Sometimes movies do more than expected on a shoestring budget, or Hollywood overestimated how many people wanted to see a particular movie. Heavy hitters this year mainly came from Disney, with Zootopia 2, the live-action Lilo and Stitch adaptations, and James Cameron's newest Avatar, continuing his streak of box office success. Also, Jurassic World Rebirth proves that dinosaurs can still make money. What movies dominated the theaters and which did not live up to the hype? Joining us now is Paul Dergarabedian, head of Marketplace Trends for Comscore. Welcome back to the show, Paul.
Great to be here, Amy. Thank you so much.
So besides the money being made, I wanted to just start with what your favorite movie of 2025 was.
Well, that's a great question. I love Sinners. That movie kind of blew my mind in the fact that
That's three for three. So now the New York Times critic Alyssa in our first segment, she loves Sinners. And then in our last segment, Scott, he loves Sinners. So yeah, Sinners. That's the one.
And the Academy voting body loved it too. A record 16 nominations for Sinners. That's quite amazing. I mean, that surpassed, you know, La La Land had 14 nominations. All About Eve had 14 nominations. Titanic had 14. Then Sinners comes along and has 16 Oscar nominations. Most impressive. Ryan Coogler, Michael B. Jordan. What a knockout of a movie and a true original. We talk about how the box office is dominated by these, you know, franchise films, known IP, the tried and true and the familiar. And yet Sinners, I think in the horror category, you see where audiences don't want to know what they're in for, as opposed to other genres like kids movies or action movies or Marvel movies. Everybody kind of knows what they are getting going in, and that comfortability makes people more, I think, or less reticent to pay for a ticket or several tickets for a kids movie. But when it comes to horror, if you look at Sinners, if you look at Weapons, certainly another horror movie that, I mean, talk about a performance by Amy Madigan in Weapons, just chilling and creepy. I still get nightmares from Amy Madigan's performance, and she's nominated for Best Supporting Actress for Weapons. So yeah, Sinners is That's my go-to, yeah, for sure.
So what was the big? What were some of the biggest movies of the year, money-wise, not just for...
Yeah.
Yeah.
So the top two movies of 2025 were both PG-rated movies. And, you know, when you have...
Oh, Paul, we're having a little bit of trouble with your Zoom. Maybe you could turn off the... Maybe you could turn off the video for us. That way we can have better...
Those are the ones that... Okay.
Yeah. If you just turn off your video, maybe we'll get a little bit better bandwidth. All
there
right.
Is better?
I think so. So, okay. Biggest movies, money-wise.
Shut it down. Can you hear me now?
Yeah, that's better. Awesome. Okay. Thank you. Yes. So, money-wise, go for it.
Well, great. So the big winners were in the PG category. In fact, PG-rated movies dominated the box office at the top of the chart in 2025. We actually, for the first time in really ever, in 24 and 25, PG-rated movies outgrossed PG-13. And we had never really seen that before. It's always those, you know, those big franchise films that are PG-13 that kind of push the envelope in terms of violence and content and that kind of thing, but are still super entertaining. But when it comes to a Minecraft movie, top grossing movie domestically, $424 million. Lilo and Stitch, the number two film, also a PG-rated family film. And think about this, Amy. When you have a movie that makes over $400 million and let's say close to $1 billion or over $1 billion worldwide, and it's a kid's movie, think of how many tickets you have to sell, because kids' ticket prices are lower. So it makes it even more impressive to get to those huge numbers. And then, of course, Superman was huge last year, the new Superman, $354 million. Jurassic World Rebirth. For me, though, the big success story, though, of the year has to be Zootopia 2. It opened way back on Thanksgiving. It's still in the top 10. That movie is over $1.8 billion worldwide. It's the highest grossing animated film, Motion Picture Association rated film of all time. So Zootopia 2 just continues to be the gift that keeps on giving.
Mm. It feels like for movies, the budgets keep getting bigger and bigger. So if successful movies, do they have to make back their total budget to be considered a success?
Yeah, they kind of do. I mean, in terms of the return on investment, the profitability, that's really key. And I think that's the issue with some of the movies that were terrific films, but boasted big stars, but didn't make a lot of money at the box office, like The Smashing Machine with Dwayne Johnson or Christie with Sydney Sweeney. And so those movies, and the Bruce Springsteen movie, Deliver Me From Nowhere, films all, and once one battle after another, very expensive motion picture to produce. So at the end of the day, I mean, what happens is you're splitting the box office, you know, all those monies made at the box office, about half of that goes to the theater owners and the other half goes back to the studios and then all the production partners and all that. So getting to the level where you're profitable can be a heavy lift, especially for a movie that costs, let's say, over $100 million to produce, maybe close to that to market and advertise around the world. I think the budget factor is key. If they can keep the budgets down, it makes it, you know, it then makes sense to spend all that dough on these films. But if you're just spending big money, you're going to have to hope you're going to make it back either on subscriptions, that people will go to, let's say, Disney Plus, Amazon, Netflix, the various streaming services, Apple, to get movies and pay for them there. So there's other revenue streams, but in terms of that theatrical box office, you're taking a big swing with these movies. Often it can pay off, other times it doesn't. And then again, the value of a movie to me is more about how it moves me. Like, is it a great film? But that doesn't pay the bank account. Mm-hmm. That doesn't put money in the bank. So yeah, it's all those things come into play for sure.
This is All Sides on 89.7 NPR News. We're talking about movies and money with Paul Darragarabedian, head of marketplace trends at Comscore. What about pure profit? Are there any movies over the past year that were made on a shoestring budget and then made it big, made a ton of money?
Well, you know, it's interesting. There are very few movies that are made on a shoestring budget. I mean, they're all pretty expensive. Look at films from, for instance, like A24. They make those really cool filmmaker-centric films. Neon is another, Focus Features. you know, those movies, but they can still be rather expensive. You know, I look at a movie like Marty Supreme, one of my favorite movies that opened last year. Timothy Chalamet has Money in the Bank every Christmas. It seems like whether it be a Dune movie, and we're going to have Dune Part 3 opening against, for now, Avengers Doomsday. So we're calling that Doomsday. Housemaid is another one that I think had a, you know, reasonable budget. And that's another one, just like Zootopia 2, which continues to play well into the over Super Bowl weekend. It did quite well. That movie opened months ago, really, and just continues to draw audiences. And that's another original. I know it's based on a book, but it's not a known IP in terms of the movie world. And they're making a sequel already. So that one definitely justified its budget, that star power that was in that film. That was really a great movie that keeps, again, it's those long-term movies, those films that play for a long time. And real quick, I just want to mention the horror genre had a record year in 2025, $1.426 billion in horror movie box office alone in 2025. That's a new record. And of course, you can thank Sinners, one of the top movies that earned almost $300 million domestically. The horror genre. And generally, you know, when you talk about return on investment, generally movies that are horror films don't require a huge budget. Look at Iron Lung that just opened from YouTuber and influencer Markiplier. Mark Fishback is his name. And that movie's up to over $31 million. That had a very modest budget. And getting that YouTube audience, his engaged YouTube audience, to get on board with that horror movie, it was a contender for the top spot last weekend. Send Help, a terrific Sam Raimi film featuring Rachel McAdams, a horror thriller, if you will, like Misery meets Castaway or something. It's so great. So I love the horror genre, the thriller genre. You don't have to spend a bunch of money. And again, Send Help, a true original. And we've got a lot of huge movies on the way. In 2026.
Well, let's talk for just a second about Netflix, because Netflix originals K-pop Demon Hunters and Frankenstein received many award nominations. Frankenstein's right. Even nominated for Best Picture. Here's a small clip from Frankenstein.
My maker told his tale. And I will tell you mine.
So do you think this sends a message to film producers that streaming releases can be beneficial? Because Marty Supreme took one tact where it was theaters only, but then K-pop Demon Hunters and Frankenstein was the opposite. What do you think?
Yeah, and I think, look, every streaming service knows the value of a theatrical release, and certainly you have to play in a theater, even in a limited run, to be considered for an Oscar nomination. And Frankenstein, Guillermo del Toro, an incredible filmmaker, 9 nominations for that film. I think what everyone wants, what theater owners want, is that the Netflix, Warner Brothers deal, you know, Warner Brothers had an incredible year in 25. They really, they just absolutely came on strong with a Minecraft movie in April, Sinners that also opened that month, Superman, F1, so many great movies from Warner Brothers. So I think what we want to see is that they honor that. But yes, absolutely. I mean, if a film, I believe it should play in a theater on a big screen, at least for a qualifying run to be considered. And the K-pop phenomenon is incredible. I mean, just this past weekend, there was a K-pop movie, Stray Kids, that did incredibly well around the world, $19 million globally for that film. So there's definitely a market out there for these films. Streaming, to me, streaming and the big screen movie theaters are additive and complementary, not adversarial. People who love watching content at home also love going out to the movies, just like people who love listening to music at home love going to concerts, or we like to cook at home, but we also go out to a restaurant. But I think the industry and those who work, especially on the production side of big screen movies, want to see a commitment by streamers to the theatrical experience, because again, for them, it's additive. Films that play in a theater first have more value once they hit streaming. But Netflix's model has not been theatrical. They are a streaming service. But I think we're seeing this coming together like a hybrid model of where streamers absolutely, look at Amazon MGM. I mean, obviously, there is this combination where you have streamers and those companies that are known for theatrical releases teaming up. I mean, look at Apple and Warner Brothers with F1. That was a perfect partnership, another film that got Oscar nominations.
So we only have about a minute left, but I wanted to get you to weigh in on an app called Letterboxd. It's for people who love movies. Can you tell me about it and just very briefly?
Yeah, so Letterboxd is an app where you can be a critic and you can have your Marshall McLuhan 15 minutes of fame amongst your friends, family, and others rating and reviewing movies on this app. And then that gets shared. You can share it with everyone in the world if you like. And you get sort of an aggregate of what people are thinking about certain movies. But you can also go and see what is your sister or brother-in-law, what are their favorite movies? So it's a communal app that allows people to discuss film, to kind of show what their tastes are, because everybody's got an opinion. You ask anyone about a movie, you'll say you love a movie, and then somebody invariably disagrees with you. Oh, I hated that movie. That happens all the time. This is a way to put that in the public forum via an app, and it really shows how much love and passion people have for the movies.
Well, I want to thank you so much for your time today. We've been talking with Paul Dare-Garabedian, head of Marketplace Trends for Comscore. Thanks for joining us today, Paul.
Thank you so much, Amy. I really appreciate it.
And this is All Sides on 89.7 NPR News. Thanks for joining us today, listeners. If you missed any part of today's show, listen back at WOSU.org/allsides or subscribe to our podcast. This is 89.7 NPR News. I'm Amy Jurevich.
This is Tanya Mosley, co-host of Fresh Air. You'll see your favorite actors, directors, and comedians on late-night TV shows or YouTube. But what you get with Fresh Air is a deep dive. Spend some quality time with people like Billie Eilish, Questlove, Ariana Grande, Stephen Colbert, and so many more. We ask questions you won't hear asked anywhere else. Listen to the Fresh Air podcast from NPR and WHYY.